Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who discusses recent natural disasters and political violence suffered by the people of Haiti. Mary Boyle, with Common Cause, who examines the ethics charges against Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and explains why her group is calling for his immediate resignation. And presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who explains the goals of his independent run for the White House. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
At the recent meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, anti-debt campaigners expressed outrage that the finance ministers of wealthy nations failed to cancel the debt of the world's poorest countries. Hopes had risen at the conference of G7 ministers when Gordon Brown, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, presented a proposal for the IMF to finance the debt owed to it by revaluing its 100 million ounces of gold to equal its market value, nearly six times the IMF logged book value, or about $45 billion. However, the reform plan got bogged down by the American demand that any debt relief program include cancellation of the Iraqi debt. Other nations, such as Germany and Japan, object to canceling all debt for poor nations. Gold-producing nations, including South Africa, also feared the plan would depress gold prices and hurt government revenues. 8 years ago, the IMF and World Bank launched a plan to reduce the debt of 41 mostly African developing nations if they would adopt free market economic reforms. So far, the debt burden has been reduced by a third, yet these poor nations still pay more toward debt than they do toward funding their own health and education programs. Anti-debt campaigners like Max Lawson of Relief and Development Group Oxfam lament, "Once again, the rich nations have turned up with their notebooks and not their checkbooks, and the price is paid by the world's poorest people." California Superior Court Judge Victoria Cheney has allowed a class-action human rights lawsuit against the oil giant Unocal to go to trial. The case, first filed in 1996, claims that Unocal aided in the abuse of Burmese villagers, including the use of forced labor in the construction of a $1.2 billion natural gas pipeline. According to the Associated Press, 14 unnamed villagers claimed that Unocal's main partner in the project, the Burmese military junta, committed massive violations that include murdering a baby and raping women and girls while making way for the gas pipeline that extends into neighboring Thailand. In her September decision, Judge Cheney rejected Unocal's main argument in urging that the case be dismissed, claiming the oil company's offshore subsidiaries should be held responsible, not corporate headquarters. Dan Stormer, an attorney for the Burmese villagers, hailed the ruling, saying it is a total victory and vindication for the victims. Now Unocal will have to defend its despicable action before a California jury. Initially, a district court judge dismissed the suit, saying that Unocal was not liable. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reinstated the case in 2002, and the case was on hold awaiting a U.S. Supreme Court decision on the Alien Tort Claims Act, which the High Court upheld in June. In the disputed 2000 presidential election, 4 million votes across America were left uncounted. In 2002, responding to the Florida recount debacle, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, to modernize elections. According to American Prospect magazine, Republicans demanded and succeeded in getting language written into the law to make it more difficult for pro-democratic groups such as racial minorities or students to vote. HAVA requires that all first-time voters must show IDs at the polls, even if their names appear on the voting rolls. Such a law had been sought by the GOP for over two decades, noted Lionel Leach of the NAACP Voter Fund. In addition, the law allows states to purge lists of felons without requiring them to create another list of ex-felons whose voting rights have been restored. The law also encourages states to buy touchscreen voting machines, which critics say are prone to malfunctions and manipulation. The Help America Vote Act permits local election registrars to make it tougher for college students to vote while on campus and away from their hometown. At the College of William and Mary, the town sent students eager to register a questionnaire seeking detailed personal information. As a result, some students were prevented from voting on campus. Similar acts of intimidation were reported in Michigan and New Hampshire. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Caribbean nation of Haiti has long been known as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, and one that has endured a long history of military occupation and economic exploitation at the hands of European powers and the United States. Now, in this year of its bicentennial of independence, Haiti has suffered yet more shattering blows. In late February, the constitutionally elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was forced from office by what the popular leader charged was a United States-supported coup. After stints in the Central African Republic and Jamaica, Aristide is now living with his family in exile in South Africa. In September, Tropical Storm Jean smashed into Haiti, resulting in massive flooding which has claimed the lives of 3,000 people in the city of Gonaïves alone. The storm was so destructive, in part because Haiti is almost completely deforested, as impoverished families cut down trees to make charcoal to sell and for cooking. Torrential rains rushed down the denuded hillsides into the valleys, where people were trapped and drowned. In the aftermath of Haiti's latest natural disaster, political violence has increased, with many Aristide supporters arrested and some killed. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C., who discusses recent tragic developments in Haiti and what the future might hold.
Well, there's no question that tension is mounting over time in Haiti. We've gone through a phase where this rather caricature of a government, the interim government under Prime Minister Gerard Latortu, a government that was essentially scripted and choreographed by Washington. There was no constitutional basis to this government, sort of put together at the last moment by the Bush administration after it orchestrated the departure of Aristide under extremely suspect circumstances. Latortu, and particularly his Minister of Justice, a man by the name of Bernard Goose, these people have launched a vendetta against former high officials of the Lavalas government, the government of President Aristide, and putting into jail on no charges, but they've jailed the former prime minister, a man named Yvonne Neptune, a highly respected, very quiet, very unideological person, basically because he was identified with Aristide. And this interim military force morphed into, after a period of 6 months or so, into a UN force led by the Brazilians, which was supposed to be 6,000 in number, but actually turned out to be 3,000, with a very restricted mandate. The mandate basically was to maintain order, but the Brazilian-led force hasn't done very much. That is, they've been much more concerned about protecting the force rather than the population. And they have been used to arrest people who have been designated by the Minister of Justice, Bernard Goose. And mind you, Goose himself is not a highly regarded lawyer. He is more of a Rasputin who has been a lethal opponent of Aristide for years. But right now, in the last few days, there has been a noticeable increase both in the number of protests by supporters of Aristide, and, of course, the government has been cracking down on Aristide individuals and clubs and installations and so forth, as if this was one of its mandates. And, of course, the irony here is that Aristide was a constitutional president elected by a majority of the population. In fact, it was a landslide. And the current government has no legitimacy. So you have the current government earmarking the legitimate government for a crackdown. And then we had Secretary of State Powell the other day, who has steadily moved to the far right in his Latin American policy. We see him coming out with a statement saying that the Aristide people are causing problems, which is a very regrettable analysis of the situation, because the Aristide people are the victims rather than the instigators. And that has characterized the whole situation in Haiti ever since last January, which eventually led to the overthrow of the ouster of Aristide at the end of February.
Larry Burns, do you think there's a connection between the devastation of Tropical Storm Jean last month and the current political unrest?
There's been a very marked connection. First of all, the government, the La Tortue government, was absolutely hopeless. It did nothing during the hurricane. They didn't even bother to declare a national radio grid and call upon Haitians, who do listen to radios, to go to higher ground. I mean, that was known from the very beginning, that the people in the low ground would be terribly affected by the tropical storm Jean. For that reason alone, it should have been removed. But of course, the only force that could remove it now, I guess legally, would be the United Nations.
What are the prospects for a return to a legitimate government in Haiti? Elections are now scheduled for next year, right?
For the time being, it's unlikely. Vaguely in the year 2005, but one doubts whether they're going to take place then. I mean, it's just, first of all, the U.S. is going to have to face up to the harsh fact that if allowed to run, Aristide will once again win. And how are they not going to allow Aristide to run when the Haitian Constitution allows him to?
That was Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact the group by calling area code 202-223-4975 or visit their website at www.coha.org. As the nation prepares to vote for president and members of Congress this November, the House Ethics Committee issued two admonishments for three recent cases of improper conduct to Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. The reprimand, issued unanimously by Republicans and Democrats on the committee, came after a several months-long investigation into charges that the Texas representative had offered a political favor to a fellow GOP representative in exchange for his vote on the controversial Medicare prescription drug bill. Another matter involved the majority leader's inappropriate request for the Federal Aviation Administration to assist in tracking down an airplane used by Texas Democratic legislators to leave the state to hamper a controversial vote on redistricting. Other charges are still pending. In the wake of the Ethics Committee report, several citizen watchdog groups and Democratic congressional leaders have called on DeLay to step down. But many of the majority leader's Republican colleagues say his continued leadership position may hinge not on concerns about ethical conduct, but rather on the results of the coming congressional election. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mary Boyle, press secretary with Common Cause, who examines the ethics charges against Tom DeLay and explains why her group is calling for the powerful majority leader's immediate resignation.
Well, what the Ethics Committee found in a period of less than a week is that he violated three House rules. One of them was that he asked a federal agency, that being the Federal Aviation Administration, to help locate a private plane that was involved in a political spat in Texas. They admonished him for holding a fundraiser for the energy industry that created the appearance that, at minimum, that the donors had special access to Tom DeLay, which is against the rules. The previous week, they admonished him for offering a political favor to another Republican member of Congress in exchange for his vote on a contentious Medicare bill.
As I understand it, Tom DeLay also is under the cloud of an investigation ongoing in Texas involving corporate contributions to his political action committee there. Maybe you could just say a brief word about that.
Sure, that's correct. He has a political action committee called TRIMPAC. It is illegal in Texas for corporations to make political contributions. There has been a big, long investigation. About 2 weeks ago, three of Tom DeLay's top aides were indicted in connection to this. Now, Tom DeLay hasn't been indicted in connection to this and apparently has not even been interviewed by authorities. But we think, because of the fact this investigation has kind of reached so into his inner circle, that there's even more need to look closely at what he's doing.
Tom DeLay has responded by saying these charges are politically motivated, but I wonder if you would put that in the context of the 50-50 split between Democrats and Republicans in the Ethics Committee.
I mean, it's remarkable that he can try to brush this off as partisan politics, given that the Ethics Committee is made up of 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans. And on all of these violations that I have just mentioned, all 5 Republicans have voted unanimously with the Democrats and are in agreement that he violated these rules.
Common Cause and other citizen groups are calling for Tom DeLay to step down as majority leader. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with the nationwide campaign to pressure him to do that.
Sure. We are one of a number of watchdog organizations that have asked for his resignation. In addition, one of the things that Common Cause is doing, and anyone who's listening wants to help, you can go to www.commoncause.org and sign our petition. We are collecting tens of thousands of signatures. We're going to present them to Congress, all in an effort to get him to step down.
As far as an independent investigation, is that still possible, or because we have the Ethics Committee refusing to go further, that's a dead end?
I think that's a dead end. One of the allegations in the original complaint that Representative Chris Bell filed, the Ethics Committee did not really address, and that had similar allegations to what is going on in Texas. And the Ethics Committee basically said, we're not going to take any action on this pending the outcome in Texas. So if there was some kind of extraordinary outcome in Texas involving Tom DeLay, that's not to say they couldn't go back and revisit that part of the complaint.
What does Tom DeLay's case say about the way Congress generally conducts business involving quid pro quos, political horse trading, and the influence of big money on legislation?
Well, I mean, I think Tom DeLay is a particularly good example of someone who's wrapped up in the culture of abuse of money in politics in Congress, but it's certainly not limited to him. I think one of our biggest concerns that we are seeing right now out of this Congress, I mean, there are always going to be this kind of money and politics issues, but we are seeing something that's arguably just as serious, which is in undermining and in ignoring often of the process by the Republican leadership that is in charge. When I say that, I mean that Republicans are routinely kind of shutting out the minority voices and basically not running Congress as it should be, which is designed to let all voices be heard. We did a report on looking closely at the Medicare bill, and we examined a series of incidents. I mean, things like Democrats being shut out of a conference committee that decides the final version of a bill, you know, members of Congress being given a very lengthy 100-page bill an hour or two before they're supposed to vote on it, and they expected to, you know, cast a vote without obviously being able to read the whole thing. And it's this kind of undermining of the process that we're very concerned about.
That was Mary Boyle, press secretary with Common Cause. Contact the group by calling area code 202-833-1200. Or visit their website at www.commoncause.org. As the 2004 presidential election approaches, opinion polls suggest that with an extremely tight race between President Bush and Senator John Kerry, independent candidate Ralph Nader could again influence the outcome of the campaign. In the aftermath of the 2000 election, which saw numerous flaws in the Florida vote count and a razor-thin margin between Vice President Al Gore and George W. Bush, many Democrats blame Nader for their eventual loss at the hands of a Supreme Court decision. After Nader announced his 2004 candidacy, the Democratic Party leadership made a determined effort to talk him out of another run for the White House. When this failed, hardball tactics were employed to keep him off the ballot in as many states as possible. The 2-time Green Party presidential candidate failed this year to win that party's endorsement. Instead, Nader is running under the Reform Party banner in some states and as an independent in others. Critics accuse Mr. Nader of accepting campaign contributions from Republican activists who they say are giving funds in an effort to siphon off votes from Senator Kerry in key battleground states. And although Nader rejects the charge that he will be a spoiler in this election, more than 70 former progressive supporters of the Consumer Advocates 2000 campaign have signed a letter urging support for the Kerry Edwards ticket in swing states in order to defeat George Bush. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ralph Nader, who talks about the goals of his campaign and answers criticism directed at his candidacy from many former allies.
Well, these are big lies about Republicans supporting us that have been put forward by the Democrats to cover their dirty tricks. They're the ones who've hired corporate Republican law firms like Kirkland Ellis, Ken Starr's law firm, unleashing in Ohio alone 50 corporate lawyers to try to get us off the ballot and doing the same thing all over the country. This campaign is designed to demonstrate by stressing the corrupt political system how much we need a political reform movement, how flaccid and surrendering are the liberal intelligentsias in this country, and demonstrate how converging the two parties are in corruptly turning our government over to the corporate supremacists to fund both campaigns. We need a political reform movement in this country, and if we can't start it big time, we have to start it at a more modest level, so after November 2, it can gain headway and momentum.
Is one of the goals of this year's campaign by you and Peter Kamejo to build a party? And if so, what party? Because with the Greens endorsing David Cobb and you're operating with the Reform Party ballot in some states, is that part of the framework of what you're trying to do here?
Well, it would be a nice thing to do. It depends on November 2. It depends how much energy progressive have in this country for countering what appears to be an endless energy of the extreme right wing. So we'll see. If people go for the least worst and vote for Kerry without making any demands on him and pulling him in the direction of their agendas while the corporations are pulling Kerry constantly in their direction, then they're going to have a credibility crisis after November 2. How can the anti-war movement supporting a pro-war candidate, John Kerry, have any credibility after November 2 when either one of them is going to escalate the war and the devastation and the bloodshed and the cost in Iraq?
You met with John Kerry a few months ago. What was that meeting like, and what did you take away from that meeting? I mean, there was a few nice words from both you, as I remember reading in the papers the next day.
Well, it was a meeting where we exchanged, obviously, views. He was quite nervous about our campaign, but he didn't say he wanted us to drop out. On my point of view, I tried to get him to face up to putting some meat on his rhetoric, which is he's not making corporate crime, fraud, and abuse a big issue. And that affects millions of people with pensions and lost their jobs like Enron and Worldcom collapse and small investors. I mean, it's a big vote-getting issue, but he wouldn't take it. I mentioned that he had said to the New York Times he wanted to end corporate welfare as we know it, and he wouldn't take grips with 10 of the worst corporate welfare boondoggles, like the big subsidy to drug companies and the oil and gas and coal companies. And I left the meeting with the sense that he was going to let his dogs loose to try to get us off the ballot. And indeed, a couple of days later, I talked to Terry McAuliffe, and he told me he was encouraging all these efforts to intimidate, harass, file phony lawsuits to get us off the ballot in states like Arizona and Oregon, Florida, and elsewhere. We fortunately have won 80% of our state Supreme Court decisions, and we're on the ballot probably in over 36, 37 states. But that is not going to play well, I think, after the election for the Democratic Party. They're going to pay a price for this.
If John Kerry and George W. Bush were the only ones in the ballot and you weren't running, you and Peter Kamejo were not running this year, who would you vote for?
None of the above.
You would stay on?
No, I'd go down and write none of the above. I mean, they're both pro-war, both pro-bloated military budget. They won't challenge it. Both pro-Patriot Act. Kerry has sided with corporations like nuclear power industry, biotech industry. He hasn't distinguished himself in his years in the Senate. He hasn't even been a third as good as Ted Kennedy, his senior senator. He has to be dragged into taking a stand on raising the minimum wage, and then he wants $7 an hour by 2007. I mean, who's he kidding? Who can live on that?
What's your response to the group of former supporters in 2000 who've come out asking voters, progressive voters, to cast a ballot in the critical swing states for Kerry instead of you?
They've completely lost their nerve. Point one is they stated, quote, while we strongly disagree with Kerry on the war and other issues, end quote, we urge voters to vote for Kerry in the closed states. Well, why didn't they make demands on Kerry? Why did they give Kerry a free ride, especially when they know that he's for more war in Iraq? The second, they didn't have the courtesy to urge voters in the safe states, as they're called, Texas and California and New York, to vote for the Nader-Kamau ticket, whose agenda and record represents everything they've been writing for and urging. And this is cream of the crop, and they've lost their nerve.
What do you say in response to their concern that there's so much at stake here this year, that they're concerned about endless war, erosion of civil liberties, the shredding of the Bill of Rights if Bush is reelected? I mean, they seem to think that reelecting Bush would be a real problem for all of us in this country, and despite their misgivings about Kerry, they want people to vote for him to prevent a reelection.
What's Kerry going to give him? He's going to give him more war. He's going to give him renewal of the Patriot Act. He voted for it. He hasn't spoken out against it in this campaign. He stands for dozens of subjects and policies that are contradicting their stance. What do they expect to get from Kerry? That's the interesting question that they should ponder. And the other question is, when are they ever going to get out of the rut of least worst? They have no end logic, because every 4 years there'll be a least worst. Are they ever going to build a new political movement?
That was independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Contact his campaign at area code 202-265-4000 or visit their website at www.votenader.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.